You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Monday the 28th of July. Ko Amanda Jane Robinson, toku ingoa. My name is Amanda Jane Robinson. I'm joined in studio by producer Kelly Enright. Hi Kelly.
Hello, how are you?
Good, good. How are you?
Oh, fabulous.
AKA also from the next week, Wire host Kelly Enright. Very exciting.
Exciting.
On the show today, we've got a whole lot. We've got a feature about plastic-free July. So Kelly spoke to sustainable.org and Common Sense Organics on the success and importance of plastic-free July. We also have our regular chat with the National Party. Today we're talking about Transport Minister Simon Bridges claiming vindication after being cleared of trying to improperly influence officials keeping a report secret. We're also talking to him about immigration changes, so that will be good. Also, we have our regular neighbourhood watch for all the latest in Australian news. And then later on in the show, we'll have an interview with one of the project managers for a book called The Roaring Silence. So looking forward to that. Remember, if you have anything you'd like to add throughout the show, give us a text on 5395. Or if you want to call in, that's cool too. You can call in on 309 3879. But first up on the show today, single-use plastic is a poison to our environment as we continually dispose of material that was designed to last forever. This means plastic never breaks down. It only breaks apart and litters our oceans and landscapes with toxins. Producer Kelly Enright spoke to the CEO of sustainable.org, Rachel Brown, on the Plastic Free July initiative and the urgency we face to be rid of single-use plastic items.
Sustainable Business Network's an organisation that's got a lot of people connected to it, so we feel like we're the and also a bunch of people who care about these things in the business space. So we feel like we can do two things. One is help inform our businesses on the issue. You know, lots of single-use plastic isn't necessary, and the problem is it ends up in the natural environment. So we just need to stop using it.
So what are the most kind of common single-use plastics that are being used at the moment?
Well, mainly it's things like plastic bags, you know, when you go shopping. Plastic straws are really bad. They're used a lot more than they need to be. Plastic cups is another one, so takeaway cups particularly. And then just general plastic containers. That's the biggest group.
Right. And what was kind of the aim of Plastic Free July as a whole?
So Plastic Free July is a competition with yourself, really, to try and work out how to avoid any single-use plastic. So by single use, we mean something that's just been used once, like I was talking about with plastic bags. But it's also things like, you know, when you get sushi, you get a sushi container and you end up with that little sushi, you know, that little fish.
The little soy sauce bottle.
Then that's filled with single use plastic stuff. So that is a really good thing to work on. So that's what we're really trying to do, is just raise awareness of all that single-use stuff and think about ways of not having it in the first place.
I'm guessing it's quite difficult. You can't really record the progress. Do you know the impact that it's had on these businesses or people that have done it?
That's a really good question. There isn't any measurement on this that I'm aware of. Mm. And so all we all do is share stories with each other.
Yep.
So there are, mainly through social media, there's groups of people who share what they're doing and share what they're tackling with, but it's just not measured.
Why is there such a sense of urgency here? Why do we need to cut out plastic so urgently?
Well, if you ever go to the beach and you have a look down while you're walking along the beach, you'll see there's lots of tiny little bits of plastic. And they can be things from plastic bags to broken up plastic bags, but just to tiny little pieces of plastic. Very soon, we're going to have more bits of plastic in the ocean than fish. And the problem is that a lot of the creatures in the ocean eat the plastic and then they die. So, you know, it's a really devastating problem that we're having, and we just can do better than that.
Is there any relation between, you know, New Zealand's plastic waste and this plastic patch that's been found in the South Pacific?
Oh, bound to be. But the plastic gets into ocean currents and it moves around the world. So that'll be a little bit of ours and a little bit of others.
And for maybe people that are listening for alternatives, what kind of things do you suggest or, yeah, as alternatives for plastic?
Yeah, okay. The first thing I'd say, there's two things. One is think about what you're doing when you're eating on the go. And the other one is thinking about what you're doing when you're shopping. So when you're eating on the go, there's a bunch of things like bring your lunch in a reusable container. The other thing is, you know, plastic wrap, shrink film, all that stuff gets used a lot if you make your own lunch. But don't. You can get these really cool things called honey wrap, which is, you know, it's just a really cool reusable wrap that you can put around your sandwich. Reusable drink bottles is another one. Lots of people carry them around. We need more of that. Plastic drink bottles are horrendous. Don't buy those bottles if you can. The other thing is when you're buying food, if you're going to a shop or whatever, take your own container with you and get them to fill that up. That's a really good thing to do. Mm. There's a bunch of cafes, and we've actually listed some. If you go and check out our website, there's a bunch of members who do this and allow this. But take your own cup.
Yeah.
Get a reusable cup, yeah. Take it into a cafe.
And so many of them give discounts as well for doing that, don't they?
I was going to say, ask for a discount. Yeah. If they don't, just say, hey, listen, I'm saving you some money. How about a wee discount here? The other thing is, even if you don't have your cup with you, I don't know, I'm a fast coffee drinker. It doesn't take long just to sit down and gulp your coffee and go. Mm. So if you're doing a coffee on the run, just slow down, drink it there, and think of the planet when you do that. A really big one, a very simple one, is say no to plastic straws. Just say no. So you don't need it. You really don't need that straw.
You really don't, do you? It's just
you really don't.
Useless.
If you want to stir your drink, get a teaspoon.
Yeah.
And then when you're going shopping, grab some of those cool refillable shopping bags or a mesh bag for your produce. Those are really cool, save heaps of plastic.
Do you think we need to see a policy change in legislation over plastic bags? You know, does there need to be like a blanket charge or just getting rid of them altogether?
Listen, I think there's been a lot of lobbying of the government to try and get some legislation around this. I understand they've just said no, they're not interested in that. But, you know, there is an election coming up and these are some of the issues that need to be talked about. So, yeah, ideally we would have some legislation around it. Voluntary initiatives work for the willing, but there's a lot of people who just don't think about it.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
I then talked to a Common Sense Organics spokesperson, Marion Wood, about the involvement with Plastic Free July and how the customers responded to the eco-friendly alternatives.
One of the things that was brought up quite recently by a customer was the number of plastic bags we were using in our specials. And we looked at that, and it's terribly easy to get into using plastic bags because it's, you know, it's the quickest and easiest way to do it. So we looked at what we were doing. We'd be using 95,000 plastic bags on a single-use plastic bag for our specials. We've now moved from using single-use plastic on our specials, done away with that entirely, and we are bagging the vegetables and we're putting the fruit in paper bags. We do heaps of things. We have fruit and vegetables that you can just help yourself to. No plastic required. We have bulk bins that you can bring your own containers for. No plastic required. We have stainless steel bottles. We have stainless steel straws. Wherever we can, we try to replace plastic with something that is more durable.
Awesome. And have customers had quite a positive response to this? You don't have people coming in wondering, I need to just quickly use a plastic bag, or I just need to use a container, or...
Common Sense Organics has actually charged for plastic shopping bags for nearly 10 years. And we are delighted that all the mayors are getting behind charging for plastic bags, and we really hope that the government will get on board with that too. But you need to also provide alternatives. So we also encourage our customers to bring back plastic bags that they've got that are clean, and... other customers can choose to use a clean plastic bag if they haven't got their own recycled bag. But we also sell reusable bags, and we're just getting into working with Boomerang Bags. They're an amazing group. They are a not-for-profit. They make all these bags out of cloth, and then they work with businesses for people to borrow bags if they've forgotten to bring their bags and to bring it back.
So why is this such a pressing issue at this time?
It's just that plastic is now everywhere, and single-use plastic is just being used more and more. There was more plastic used in the last 10 years than in the whole of human history. So, yeah, I mean, there's just a crazy amount of plastic around, and that's why we think, you know, it's a really good idea not only to charge for plastic bags, but also for producers of goods that are packaged in plastic to have to take responsibility for the wastage created by that plastic.
Do you think we'll need to see a change in, you know, in government policies for this to really be something we move into?
Absolutely, we need to see a change in government responsibility, because none of the supermarkets want to be the first to do it.
Mm.
They are all on board with the idea, I think. And they would all be quite happy to charge as long as everybody else is. So this is exactly where we need government to step in and say, okay, it's going to be across the board. But we also need government to step in and implement regulations to make sure that producers of plastic take responsibility for the waste that they're creating.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. We are here now for the National Party.
It's time for our weekly political chat with the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross.
Except today we're not talking to Jamie Lee Ross. He's busy today, so we're talking to National MP Paul Foster Bell. Paul, are you there?
I am, Amanda. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you today. So I guess the first kind of question topic that I have for you today is about Transport Minister Simon Bridges. So he is claiming vindication after being cleared of trying to improperly influence officials into keeping a report secret. I guess, first of all, for people who weren't aware, what was this report about?
Well, look, it was a Kiwi Rail document. It was a business case, actually, that Kiwi Rail was working on. And actually, I think, as you've said, the Ombudsman's investigation did find that there was no issues with the process that was followed by the Minister's office. And I think the Ombudsman was really clear that the Minister's office was entitled to have a view on the information being released, and that escalating that information back to the senior management of Kiwi Rail, if there was a feeling that there was something there that crossed the line in terms of commercially sensitive information being released out, that was also appropriate. And the Ombudsman did say very clearly that Minister Bridges didn't cross any lines in his engagement with Kiwi Rail. So I think, you know, there are thousands of Official Information Act requests every year. As a public servant myself, a few years ago, before I came into Parliament, I used to deal with these myself. I know that they're dealt with very seriously, they're taken seriously, but sometimes for personal privacy or national security or commercial confidentiality reasons, it is appropriate that some information's been withheld. So that's the background anyway from my point of view.
But the Ombudsman, rather, the report does say that Kiwi Rail was right in the first place to decide to release it, saying that the Minister's concerns didn't quite stack up. In particular, it dismissed claims that the report should stay secret because it was a draft or could be misleading. What's your response to that?
Well, look, the Minister's been pretty clear that, you know, his office took a view on something. And that was a view that wasn't necessarily shared by the senior management of Kiwi Rail. So there was a difference of opinion there. But what the Ombudsman was really clear about is that it is appropriate for the Minister's office to be able to see these things before they're released. And it's also appropriate for Minister's offices to engage with their departments and to have that interaction. And it didn't cross any lines or engage in political interference. I mean, it's a difference of opinion about what elements of the business case may be suitable to be released. And I don't think it's an indication of anything, you know, scarier than that, frankly.
All right. Also wanted to talk about the forthcoming immigration changes. So Prime Minister Bill English has been taking another look at some of those changes after feedback from the consultation process. The changes would have meant that any job earning less than $48,000 would no longer be considered skilled and would restrict skilled migrant visas to 3 years, after which applicants would have to exit the country and wait 12 months before becoming eligible again. So the government's now confirmed it will go ahead with the 12-month rule, but lower the minimum median annual income limit to $41,000. How significant is that, $7,000 change?
Well, look, we do think it will make some particular difference in the tourism and hospitality sectors, and also in the farming sectors, where there were concerns expressed that income level might actually rule out some very necessary and valuable workers who are unable to be replaced by Kiwis. There are parts of the country, you know, for instance, in the Southland dairy industry, there aren't available New Zealanders who are, you know, on benefits looking for work, ready to take up those positions. But let's be really clear about this. That threshold that's been reduced down to 41,000, or about 85%, it's 85% of the median wage, is only part of what's looked at when these temporary work visas are granted. And if you're on $41,000 a year, you still have to have a skill level that's assessed at being between 1 and 3 on the ANZCO skill scale. So if you're completely unskilled, that is, you're not doing a kind of work that's in really short supply, or you don't have the qualifications to back it up, and you're coming into New Zealand, there's actually a requirement that you earn a much higher level than that $41,000 before that skill exemption is granted. It is actually a really complex area. There's lots of complex and overlapping rules here. But the key message is that we have to strike that right balance between making sure New Zealanders are at the front of the queue for jobs, but also ensuring that regions have access to temporary labour so that they can continue to grow economically and that jobs can be done. So you know, I think we've struck a really good balance, and if you contrast it with the opposition parties, all of which want to decimate immigration numbers, they literally want to cut tens of thousands of immigrants, hard-working people who want to come to our country, out. I think, striking a more reasonable balance where the numbers will have to fall a little, because we're experiencing very, very high demand for places in New Zealand. But we're not talking about cutting out those tens of thousands of people that some opposition parties are.
So this isn't measuring skill just from the wages, then?
No. It's not an either-or. If you are extremely lowly skilled but have a high wage job offer here in New Zealand, you'll be able to come in. If you're extremely highly skilled, the wages of the job that you're doing are less relevant as well. But if you're in that mid-level, if you're in a mid-skilled job, there is going to be an income threshold of that 85% of the average wage. And if you actually break that down, we're not talking a huge threshold here. In many jobs, it'll be $20 an hour. And, you know, we wouldn't want to see employers taking advantage of international workers who are come here and prepared to work at the minimum wage when there are actually Kiwis who could fill those jobs. So it is a balancing act. It's not a black and white situation.
You mentioned the farming sector before, concerned about that threshold, but they're also concerned that 12-month rule would make it hard to secure experienced long-term staff. What is the reasoning behind that 12-month rule?
Well, no, that's absolutely right. Excuse me. I think the other change that the agricultural sector will be looking at, which I think is going to be really positive, will be the introduction of a new category of farm worker. At the moment, it's really a blunt tool. So if you're designated to be the manager of a dairy herd, you'll be at 5 out of 5 on the skills classification. If you're a farm labourer, a worker, you'll be at 1, but there's no provision at the moment for anything in between. So by introducing a new category at that 3 level, so 3 out of 5, I think you'll see a lot more people be able to take advantage of a farming job in New Zealand, but without disadvantaging New Zealanders. Again, this is all about making sure it's weighted so that Kiwis do get the first first bite of the cherry, as it were, and that where there are gaps after that, they can be filled by foreign workers.
So whether they are on that 1, 3, or 5 or anywhere in that range that you're saying, are any of them eligible to stay for the more than 12 months?
Yeah, absolutely. There will be a large number who will be eligible to stay for the 3 years. And actually, what we've also done is we've looked at people who have come here. For instance, in the farming industry, a lot of people from the Philippines have come, and they're very good citizens, law-abiding citizens. And they're not yet New Zealand citizens, but they behave very well in a good citizen style. And eventually, I'd like to see, in some cases, those people able to renew their visas and to have sufficient residence here in New Zealand that they can become citizens, that they can apply for a permanent residence and then perhaps citizenship beyond that. You know, New Zealand is a country made up of migrants. My ancestors, as well as being Māori, came from Scotland and Portugal and other countries as well. And I want to see people given that opportunity, particularly where we've got those gaps and that we don't have Kiwis ready to do that work.
And just lastly, Labor's immigration spokesperson Ian Lees-Galloway says that this has the potential to drive down wages. Do you agree?
Look, I don't think so. I think we've very carefully tailored it so that those different skill levels and wages are balanced. By setting it at 85% of the New Zealand median income, which is $41,500 a year, and including that requirement that people be mid-skilled, so level 1 to 3 on the ANZCO skill rating system, I think we've quite carefully balanced it so that it doesn't actually lock New Zealanders out or encourage employers, frankly, to substitute cheaper migrant labour for Kiwis who are looking for that work.
Paul, thank you so much. Talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Amanda. Have a great day.
You too. Bye. That was National MP Paul Foster-Bell speaking about the OIA ruling regarding KiwiRail and Simon Bridges, as well as forthcoming changes to immigration regulations.
That was the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross. The Wire.
It was Paul Foster-Bell, but that's fine. We have a couple of texts about our last story regarding plastic-free July. So one person is asking a very interesting question. What do you use to replace plastic rubbish bin liners? What do you think, Kelly?
Well, I did look into this a little bit because I wasn't entirely sure myself. But one lady suggested minimising your waste entirely and just instead of having a huge rubbish bin, using a small, you know, bread bag or something, right. You know, reusing something that you already have in your house. Or perhaps if you do have a lot of waste and a lot of rubbish or a lot of people in your house, then, yeah, maybe put some scrap newspaper on the bottom or something like that. So, yeah.
Nice. We also had another text about that story. For those interested in reducing household waste, to check out the Zero Waste in New Zealand Facebook group with over 7,000 members. That sounds exciting.
Sounds like a great place to start.
Yeah, for sure. After the break, we will have all the latest in Australian news with Neighbourhood Watch.
Real Groovy Records brings you the 95BFM Jazz Show, Sunday afternoons from 12 till 2.
Something new and something exciting, something new and something exciting will happen, something very new.
The Jazz Show, a show for the jazzwise and the otherwise, with your hosts, Blind Mango Chutney, Duncan Campbell and myself, Def Jim, bringing you 2 hours of the music that jazz became and the music it's becoming. The Jazz Show, Sundays from midday, proudly brought to you by Real Groovy Records, 369 Queen Street.
don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
We are back. Are you there, Nicole?
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
Are you there, Nicole?
Yes, I'm here.
There we go. How are you doing this week?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good, good. Good to talk to you again. Been a while since I was doing a Friday Wire.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, so I guess the first story we have this week, a federal minister has resigned from cabinet to clarify whether he has dual citizenship. What's that all about?
Yes, so we talked about this on Neighbourhood Watch a bit last week, but back then it was happening with the Greens Party. A few members were resigning because they found out they were dual citizens. And so now it's the Federal Resources Minister, Matt Canavan, who may not be able to sit in Parliament. So basically, in Australia's constitution, there's a provision in Section 44, which says that any person who's a citizen to a foreign power should not be able to sit either as a senator or a member of the House of Representatives. So now Canavan has resigned from the front bench to see if he's a dual Italian-Australian citizen. It's quite a unique story in a sense because he says that his mother applied for Italian citizenship in 2006 without his knowledge and applied for him at the same time, and he was 25 years old at the time. So his explanation was basically that his mother raised the possibility with him that he may be an Italian citizen after she heard about the two Greens deputy leaders resigning for the same reason. So he's checked with Italian authorities apparently, and they confirmed that the application wasn't signed by him, and so now he's seeking legal advice as to whether registering as a citizen without his knowledge or consent is valid under Italian law.
Oh my gosh!
I know. So the whole situation is just, you know, a complete mess, and I'm sure the Prime Minister regrets his recent comments about the Greens. He was saying that the members resigning was just sloppiness on the part of the party. So we'll have to wait to see what happens. I mean, who knows how many parliamentary members will have left after all this.
That's incredible, especially, yeah, considering that he didn't apply for that himself. That's great. Oh, great. His mother must have felt awful when she heard about them resigning and had to tell him, oh, no. Yeah. Oh, no.
Well, I thought she was doing something nice for him.
Yeah. Oh, that's awful. Yeah. The second story we have today, there are allegations that... Okay, I'm very confused with this one. There are allegations that people are stealing water from the Murray River.
Yes. So the Murray-Darling Basin spans most of Australia from Queensland to SA. And so SA has always had issues with there not being much water left by the time that it gets downstream. So there's been allegations that upstream irrigators are harvesting water for the basin, and the SA government, Indigenous and environmental groups, and key senators all want answers as to why water designated to return to SA is allegedly being used for cotton farms up north. So there was a Murray-Darling Basin plan a while ago in which taxpayers bought billions of litres of water in order to ensure that it made it downstream and wasn't used up by these irrigators. And so an investigation by Four Corners, which is a current affairs program on our national broadcaster, they found that despite this plan, the water still wasn't making it to the southern part of the basin. So South Australia's Water Minister, Ian Hunter, says that if their investigation is correct, then New South Wales has some serious questions to answer. But they have, of course, denied all of the allegations. So it's not really clear what's happening, if the government's aware of it or not. But it's interesting.
Yeah, that's wild. I was thinking when I saw this story, I was thinking it must be something like art thieves, just like in a van, or like petrol siphoning all the water out, just like... got balaclavas or the pantyhose balaclavas just like stealing water in buckets out of the river. Not as exciting as that, but still, yeah, really intriguing. And just lastly, Queensland is set to build one of the world's longest electric vehicle highways.
Yes, so this is quite an interesting story. So the Queensland state government has announced a 2,000 kilometre network of electric vehicle charging stations, which will be coming to the state within 6 months. So it'll be one of the world's longest electric vehicle highways, with the 18-station network stretching along Queensland's east coast from Cairns to Coolangatta and west to Toowoomba. So it's sort of, I guess it's kind of a similar distance to the West Coast Electric Highway in the US, which runs from California to Washington State. and it will cost $3 million. So although there's only about 700 electric cars already on Queensland roads...
I was going to say, how often do you just see an electric car driving around?
I don't know. I haven't seen a Tesla, I don't know, like recently in the last 5 years. So there's only... so if there's only 700, I think they just want to prompt more people who can afford it to buy electric vehicles and hopefully transition to like lower emissions across the board, because as it stands, Queensland is Australia's biggest carbon polluter, and the transport sector makes up the second largest source of carbon emissions, with passenger cars alone making up almost half of that. So, you know, it's a welcome investment from an environmental perspective, and I think... you know, consumers who can afford electric cars, you know, will be pleased to hear this, because maybe they would have been hesitant to buy one without having, you know, an actual network and be confident that they can charge their cars along the way. But I don't know how readily utilised it will be in the near future, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, absolutely. Nicole, thank you so much. We'll talk to you again next week.
Yeah, talk to you then.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was indeed Neighbourhood Watch with Nicole Winning for all the latest in Australian news. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Remember, if you've got anything you'd like to chat about today, text in to 5395. We'd love to hear from you. After the break, we'll talk to one of the project managers of the book The Roaring Silence.
Have you guys heard about BFM's Winter Dump?
Having a winter dump.
Even in a housing climate where living under a rock is becoming an increasingly viable option, everyone's heard about 95BFM's Winter Dump, right? It's only the most incredible, life-altering, heart-embiggening prize pack this side of the Bombays, so hold on to your mittens, kids, because these fully set prizes could be yours.
Fresh fruit and veg delivered to you for 3 months from Farrow Online.
A year's supply of Go Healthy Verdefense vitamins.
A year's supply of Karma Cola.
A weekly meal for two all winter at Mexican Cafe.
A $500 shopping spree at Def Store.
A winter prize pack from O Natural.
A gnarly Olympus action camera thanks to Pro Gear.
A gorgeous champagne flight for two over Auckland and Rangitoto thanks to Auckland Seaplanes.
$500 to spend on new gear at AS Colour.
Custom skis from Kingswood Skis, valued at $1,350.
And a weekly feast of southern fried vegan chicken at Lord of the Fries.
95BFM Winter Dump is on now, so get entering. Go to 95BFM.com.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was Miss June with I Don't Want to Be Your Dog. Great track. Lastly, on the show today, The Roaring Silence is a book about suicide awareness comprising contributions from 79 artists, writers, poets, and a few professionals from all generations and backgrounds around Aotearoa. I spoke to the depot manager, Lynn Lawton, about the book and the project.
Last year, we'd had a number of... young people from local high school in the area take their lives. One was just three doors up the road from where we are located here in Devonport. And in the past, we've always had a concern for the whole issue of suicide. In fact, back in 2000, the Death My Space hosted an exhibition to raise awareness of that particular issue, and it looked like it was timely to do the same thing again. But this time we went about it a bit different. We felt we needed to put together some kind of document that began to demystify the whole subject of suicide and inspire conversation about it. And so we emailed or we contacted and put out into the public arena a request for people who had been through that experience or who also may have known someone who has, whether they'd like to contribute something for this book in terms of poetry or art or prose or their story or something else like that. And we were overwhelmed. We had about 100 people submit different things like that, and we put them together into a publication called The Roaring Silence.
And so of those 100, there are 79 contributors in the final product of the book.
Yeah.
How did you go about kind of selecting those submissions?
Well, there were 79, and in the end, there were 79 that actually kind of stayed in the course, and finally, after indicating they would be interested in doing something, actually submitted something. So the 79 weren't selected. They were basically anyone who contacted us and provided work like that we put into the book. And there's a section in the book that is quite, let me just say what it's titled, Raw, because it was pretty raw material, and we felt we wanted to still provide a space for it, so we put a separate section in the book, and just with an annotation at the beginning to the fact that this is a raw area, so just be aware of the sensitive content to it, of it. And so people, when they approach that section, can choose to skip over it, or else, you know, kind of, you know, be aware that it is just a person's very raw story about their own experience or someone else's.
And this was quite a community-led project. Why is that important?
Well, my experience in working in this area is that people's isolation is one of the critical factors to people finding themselves in a place where they seriously contemplate and actually take their lives. Because, I've worked with people in this area over a number of years in my previous role as a chaplain in the Royal New Zealand Navy. And we found that if people were in some way approached, were able to begin to disclose at a point that was not too far down the line, then resources could be brought to them, and they could access such resources, and very often it could change the whole course. So to me, isolation is a critical factor in people at times finding themselves at that point of no return.
And I guess suicide is still positioned as this taboo thing that's not talked about enough in New Zealand, even though we have such a high rate of it. Why do you think that is?
Well, New Zealand's one of the few countries in the world, up to recently, where you could not even in the newspaper note that a person had taken their lives, or any information about that, out of fear of copycat. And we've had a situation recently in a district health board in the South Island where Michael King was not provided the opportunity to speak to young people in that area and to provide some kind of input to them because of the view by people down there that this should not happen because copycats would take place. And so that's an example of the way it's being very much cloistered or very much, you know, put into the cupboard out of fear. I think that's been one of the key things there. And it's very interesting if you read the New Zealand Herald today, they have a lead article on the front page about it, and they comment that this very fear has not been substantiated by research that's been done, where there is someone who takes their life, if there's people at sort of a distance around them and they have, you know, not been intimately close with that person, the likelihood of that leading to that person's own suicide is very rare. But when it's within a family whānau group, well, then there's a greater chance because of the emotional impact on that person on them. So I think it's a lack of understanding of just the whole dynamic of suicide, how it happens, why it happens, and what is the nature of the dynamics amongst people when it happens. You know, all those factors have been not really understood because it's been kept hidden and not really researched and explored in a way that could be of advantage and an asset to us.
And so what do you hope people get out of this book, The Roaring Silence?
Okay, well, there's a number of aspects to this book that are critical. The first thing is we recognize it is not appropriate to put people's stories who have, you know, come back from suicide, who have lost someone, without putting some context around it that provides support. And so at the very beginning of the book, we have a series of interviews and items by people who are professionals in this field in terms of help and assistance for people in such a situation, like the Chief Coroner, Judge Neil McLean, Jeff Norcliffe, a GP, Manu Fotu, Suicide Prevention Manager at Waitemata DHB, and myself, who's worked in pastoral care and supported people in that area. So we have some very practical guidelines and ideas for people who have either lost someone or may be contemplating suicide, practical things to help them to get a hold of their situation and steps they might take to assist someone else or themselves. And the second thing is that, talked about community before, Amanda, a community can operate at a number of levels. And I suppose someone picking the book up and reading the story of someone else or a poem or seeing some artwork that resonates with them, maybe they don't realize or feel they're alone still. And that very factor of not being alone, that, you know, this is not something unique to them, may just suddenly be like a moment of light that just pulls them back from that point and begins to see how that person found their way through it, and perhaps something, you know, they might be able to grab a hold of, and it just begins to move them away from that precipice themselves.
Absolutely. And you mentioned those interviews. Can you tell me about some of your other maybe favourite submissions from the book?
Well, yeah, there's a beautiful artwork. It's a map of the sea, and it has all sorts of different little annotations across it, like a ship sailing across it saying navigation of need, or it looks like a hurricane, vortex of despair, and then a whale of kindness. So this person, you look at it and you could say, oh, that's exactly where I am. So you could find some sort of resonance with this this map this person has created. And then there's another beautiful artwork over the page here by Rod Emerson, who's an editorial cartoonist for the New Zealand Herald. And he has this picture, this little figure wandering around under a storm cloud saying, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, could be a week, could be a month, and lightning and storm under him now, on top of him now. One thing is absolutely guaranteed, the sun will eventually shine. You know, just, you know, six little cartoons like that, you know, tell an amazing story. And then there's this poem here by a person. I stumbled down the stairs in the middle of the night. I mixed up my medicine, three drops of water and a glass of gin. I heard my teeth clenching on the cold of the glass, like someone who drowns, gasping for hope. I'm trapped in a cave of myself, a soldier in a trench deeper than Mariana, fighting with the voices ricocheting inside my mind. I wanted to slip away unnoticed. I grabbed the handle to the door, but I saw happiness at the top of the stairs saying, I'm cold, please come back to bed. And this poetry and the stories of people who have been there and come back from there, or some that just really graphically tell the story of the ache that's still inside them from the loss that, you know, is there from someone that went. So I don't think there's anything else around like it that, you know, brings together so much that is both revealing, giving hope, giving guidelines, and showing that sometimes there are no answers, but, you know, there can be ways out of it.
And where can people find out more or buy the book for themselves?
Okay, the book's available at Whitcool's and some of the other shops bookshops around town, around the country. And it's, I think it's $32.99 or can be purchased at the Depot Art Space in Devonport.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Monday the 28th of July. Thank you to everyone who came on the show. We had Rachel Brown, National MP Paul Foster Bell, Marion Wood, and just now you've heard from Lynn Lawton about the book The Roaring Silence. Also, a big thank you to producer Kelly Enright.
Thanks, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Very excited to hear your first Wire host next week. Everybody should tune in.
Excited,
it's going to be great.
Nervous. It's all the same, isn't it?
Brilliant. Also, a big thank you to news director Shemina Smith. Mari is up next. I'm Amanda Jane Robinson. Have a lovely afternoon.
A 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.